say, Anin, Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Dearchild. Music is a universal language. Many of us grow up learning to sing or play an instrument from our parents, grandparents, our uncles, cousins. And family relationships can be a powerful inspiration for musicians.
I knew I had a very musical family.
Yeah. Music played a huge role in Inuit pop singer Elisabeth's family. Her uncle, George Kakadiot, was part of Sugluk, a legendary Inuit rock band, and has been a lifelong inspiration for her own musical path.
They were so unafraid to try things.
And Métis fiddler Brianna Lazotte is keeping her family's musical history alive thanks to kitchen parties and jam sessions at her grandparents' house.
That was a huge part of my childhood, just going over to my grandparents' house, listening to everybody dance and have fun.
And with a nod to the past, Kim Gucci is also looking to future generations with her latest children's album. The first-time Juno nominee sings in her family's three Indigenous languages.
I'm contributing in the best way that I know how to take some words and to preserve them in my music.
Today, it's our nod to the Junos and a conversation with three Indigenous nominees who look to family for meaning and inspiration. That's a bit of fiddle tune, I'll Bring the Bread, Just in Case, Mitch, by Brianna Lazotte from her album Winston and I. And if you haven't guessed by the energetic fiddle or the galloping percussion, Brianna is Métis. She comes from a long line of Métis musicians and grew up surrounded by music. Many generations of her family have been fiddlers, guitar players, singers, and percussionists. And they all gathered at Mushum's house for a good old kitchen party. Brianna is a first-time Juno nominee in the category for a traditional Inuit artist or group of the year. Brianna, welcome to Unreserved.
Thanks so much for having me today.
First-time guest, first-time nominee.
Yep, exactly.
Well, congratulations, first of all.
Thanks so much. I'm really, really excited.
So tell me the story behind what we just heard, the song, I'll Bring the Bread, Just in Case, Mitch.
Yeah, for sure. So it's about my friend Mitch Case. At the time of writing the tune, he was a youth representative in the Métis Nation of Ontario. He would come over to Alberta to come and watch different events. And at the time, it was the youth and seniors. So where youth and seniors all across Alberta would come together and, celebrate Métis culture and whatnot. So he came out and I just want you to imagine there's a stage and on either side of the stage, there's two monitors. And there was this really nice hashtag that they had where it was, if you use a certain like youth and seniors, you're able to have your videos, your pictures posted up for everyone to see. So there was this one video of a lady that was stuffing her purse full of bread rolls that we had from dinner. And Mitch saw this and was like, what is that? And we just laughed for like 30 minutes about it because there was crumbs everywhere. And she was like looking side to side, making sure no one was watching her like stuff her purse full of bread. We cackled, I think, for like 30 minutes about it. It was definitely, a funny memory. And that tune is written for him. And that, fun, giddy feeling that we both were experiencing watching a lady stuff her purse full of bread. So, yeah.
Nothing like a good inside joke among friends, am I right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we had mentioned that you grew up surrounded by music by your relatives at kitchen parties. Can you explain to our audience what a kitchen party is?
Yeah. So kitchen parties is exactly what it sounds like. A party that happens in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Métis community, music, and especially like kitchen parties, also known as dances, this was a huge part of like keeping our culture alive and keeping our, you know, spirits high, especially during some lower points in our history as a culture. So music and fiddling and dancing was a huge part of who we were. Not only was it because, you know, music is awesome and it's like a universal language for everybody, but the fiddle and like the spoons, they were such a portable instrument that you could play them really anywhere. Even as far back as the fur trade, voyagers would play the fiddle on the canoes to all keep in time paddling together and to also keep spirits high during long, long days of work. But it was also a huge thing in everyday life. And once a year, especially during New Year's, family members all around the community, all across the province, or all across our Métis homeland, they'd come together and just have, you know, a 10-day long party of dancing, eating bannock and dried berries and all these other things, and most importantly, playing the fiddle. The fiddle was just such a spiritual thing for Métis people because it could be somber with you and it could be happy and it could be however feeling you wanted it to be. And that's, you know, really beautiful. And that's why kitchen parties are so important, and specifically the fiddle, why it's so important to Métis people.
Yeah, we love to push the table aside and have a good kitchen party.
Yeah, exactly.
What are some of your, you know, your best memories of, you know, family kitchen parties that you've been surrounded by?
I grew up in the generation of, you know, music kind of dying down in the family. But back in like the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s, that's when my grandpa took lots of home videos. I don't know what it was, but he just always had his camera and was documenting our family. And that was really, really special because I went to a couple family kitchen parties when I was really young. I have a vague memory of me sitting underneath the kitchen table while everyone was playing, you know, watching everyone's feet tap in time with the music. But a lot of the time I was just enjoying the music through home videos. Every time we'd go over to my grandparents' house, he'd put on like a VHS tape or a CD, and he'd say like, oh, you need to watch this. I think you'd really enjoy this. And I did, you know, that was a huge part of my childhood, just going over to my grandparents' house and watching these videos, listening to everybody dance and have fun. And by the time I was old enough to really have memories and to make my own memories, a lot of the musicians either couldn't play anymore due to arthritis, were passing away, or just were, you know, far apart from where we lived, because we lived in Red Deer and a lot of them lived up north in like Fort Vermilion and near like the Northwest Territories border. So it was kind of a far drive for them to come to us and for us to go to them. So it was very rare when we got to see them. I had a dream one night when I was about 10 years old, when one of the last like really awesome fiddle players in our family passed away. It was a hard time for my family, for sure. So I had this dream where I was playing the fiddle, which I had never played before, but I was playing the fiddle, and it was in a context very similar to the ones that I've watched in home videos for like kitchen parties and whatnot. And I brought the family together. We were all enjoying bannock and the food and the drinks and the good jolly time that I would see on these videos. So when I woke up the next morning, I went up to my mom and I told her, like, I need to get a fiddle. I want to try it out. And of course, she kind of went, oh, you know, okay, because I tried pretty much every other like extracurricular in the book, like bowling, golfing, swimming, like a bunch of random stuff. And it never really stuck. But there was something different about the fiddle. And I was really lucky to have my mom, who was there, to say, okay, well, you have to fulfill your 1 year of lessons. And if you want to keep going, you can. And there was just something different about the fiddle then. And I'm really glad that my mom let me take that chance.
Yay, moms.
Yeah, yay, mom.
What was it, though, about the fiddle once you finally got it in your hands and, you know, went from dreaming to playing? But what is it that the fiddle gives you that nothing else could capture for you?
You can tell everyone was really happy that the fiddle music was coming back. Also watching my grandparents' face light up. But it just felt different in a way that it came easier than other things. Like with sports and with, you know, other extracurricular creative things, it never stuck that well. And I had a hard time learning, and I, you know, had a hard time either practicing or putting in effort to do what I signed up for. But once I started playing the fiddle, music was like, you know, my thing. And everyone knew I was a musician and could rarely see me without an instrument. It just kind of felt the most natural out of everything I had tried.
Yeah. You know, fiddle music, particularly Métis fiddle music, is really, it has a unique sound, you know, different than violin music or other kinds of sort of square dancing music. What is it that makes, you know, Métis fiddle music in particular different than other types in your mind?
I love this question. The fiddle and the violin are the same instrument, but the way that you play it and the way that the music you want to show off and showcase is what makes it different. And specific for Métis fiddling, how it's different from other sorts of fiddling is the rhythm that accompanies it. The fiddle comes from the European side of our Métis culture. So we have a lot of Irish, a lot of Scottish, a lot of like French influence when it comes to our music. But the thing that makes it different than those genres even is the horse gallop rhythm. So the dum chicka dum chicka dum chicka dum. That horse gallop, it really highlights the danceability and the sociability that a lot of other, you know, genres they have, but it's not the same, right? Because with old time country fiddle music, it's boom chick, like boom chick, boom chick, boom chick. But with the horse gallop, dum chicka dum chicka dum, it has a little bit of a lilt to it that makes you want to dance and makes you want to jig. And that's the whole point of Métis music, is it's danceable and it's easy to socialize to and easy to, you know, learn those basic rhythms and make it your own, right?
Cool.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Now I'm going to be listening for that little beat every time I hear a Métis fiddle tune. Now, this is your first Juno nomination for your first album, Winston and I. And I'm sure everybody wants to know, who is Winston?
Yeah. Actually, Winston and I is my second album that I've come out with. My debut album came out when I was about 17, 18, and you can only find it either as a physical CD or on Bandcamp. I haven't posted it out in the public because I was like a baby when I was playing those. And I didn't really know who I was as an artist. Maybe I'll release it one day. Maybe I'll put it on Spotify or something one day. But Winston and I is an album about me and my fiddle. So my fiddle is Winston.
Ah.
So Winston, the name comes from a fiddle player in Saskatchewan named Winston Whatney. And he actually owned the fiddle before I did. So I thought it was so cool because I loved his playing. And I also had a friend who was related to him. So I actually met up with Winston at like Tim Hortons in Sylvan Lake one day when I was like 16. And I was like, oh, this is the best day. And I had just bought Winston, my fiddle, and I told him, I was like, oh, this is my fiddle, and I was told that it was, you know, yours. And he was like, oh, that's so cool. So I just thought it was so special, and I just really loved the way that it played. And all the songs that are on Winston and I on the album are tunes that I have written on this fiddle. So when I was creating the album, I was really struggling with like, what is the overall theme for this album? Because my first album, it was called Scratch 'Em, and it was all tunes that my family had played, like all the jam tunes and traditional tunes and a couple of my own. But when I was coming up with Winston and I wanted to re-record my two songs that were on my first to just, you know, revamp them. And I just graduated university, so I was like, oh, I want to see if I could make these sound different and make them sound more like how I do now. And I was sitting there, I was really struggling to come up with a name. I had gone through so many different variations of names that I was like, there has to be like some sort of theme that's in, you know, in this album. And I realized, I was looking at my fiddle, I was like, oh my gosh, it's me and it's Winston that are the common thread for all these songs. Because all the songs, when you listen to the album, there's not a lot of like tunes that sound the same, or because there's like a really traditional sounding Métis one that starts off the album with like my great uncle laughing, because that one's about him from one of my grandpa's home videos.
Yeah.
But then it also has like electric guitar later, and it has the horns, and it has a bunch of other things. So it's like such an eclectic collection of songs. But yeah, Winston and I are the common thread in all of them.
That's so nice. I know Winston Watney. He's such a lovely, generous, kind man. Does he know that you named your fiddle after him?
I think I told him, but I can't remember. It's been a long time, and I haven't really seen him since. So he definitely is a huge inspiration of mine, and I mean it in the most, you know, sincere and respectful way that, like, my fiddle is, you know, named after such an awesome musician.
Yeah, I'm going to tell on you next time I see him.
Oh, no.
But only in the best way. What do your family think? What have they been impacted by this album?
It's really cool because they were really proud of the first project that I released because it was about my family. And scratchin' was actually a phrase that my great-grandfather used to say when he wanted to jam out a tune. So he'd say, let's scratchin', let's scratchin' out, you know, like a tune or whatever. That was a huge thing for my family, was having that phrase out there. But Winston and I, it's, you know, it was in a different context of like, these are tunes that I wrote, and with my experience with family and with Métis culture and with my own, you know, life experiences as a young adult learning how to live on my own. And in particular with Chikang Kang, the first track on the album is written about my great uncle, and he was the last fiddle player that passed in my family, who was the one that really impacted the family the most. And he was just such a kind-hearted and lovable person. I, you know, have some vague memories with him. He would play this little game with us kids where he'd kind of wrap our hands like this on top of each other. He'd grab them and go, Chikang Kang, Chikang Kang. Then he'd tickle us until we laughed, like cried or peed ourselves, whichever one came first. And he, you know, not only was he an awesome, like, jokester to be around, and guy that was just, you know, whenever he'd laugh, he would light up a room, but he was also just a really great musician. He was in a band with his brothers called the Native Sons, and they had actually played for the Queen in the Northwest Territories back in the 70s. So I was like, that's so cool. And when they heard, you know, I wrote this song about him, and then the tune ended with him playing that game with my sister through a home video, I had one of my cousins come up to me and say, I actually forgot he played that game with all of us. And you just brought back a memory that I forgot long, long ago. So those, you know, those moments are very special. And I'll always really remember those, you know, and my family really appreciated that, like, his memory isn't lost and his games and our family traditions are not lost, right? It's kind of documented now in an album.
That's beautiful. How does it feel to be carrying on, you know, your family's legacy as a Métis musician?
It's scary. It's, you know, intimidating at times. Having so much family history with music and fiddle playing, you know, I'm starting to tell these family stories to a bigger audience, and especially because of this Juno nomination. It's awesome, and it's really scary. It's really cool. And I'm excited to see where else my music goes and my family traditions go, because I've still got a lot left in me with memories and tunes that I have, you know, I'm writing currently. So it's like there's still lots to come. But I don't know. It's a huge thing for the Lizzlots. And I'm really honored to be sharing such amazing stories with so many people now.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with me today and teaching me things I didn't know about the fiddle.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on the show.
Brianna Lizotte is a Métis fiddler living in Edmonton. Winston is her fiddle. She received her first Juno nomination for her album Winston and I in the category for Traditional Indigenous Artist or Group of the Year. Brianna and Winston have been to many Métis events across Turtle Island. One of her favorite places to visit is Métis Crossing by Smoky Lake, Alberta. The Métis Cultural Interpretive Destination is a place for Métis people to celebrate and further their culture. That's where Brianna met the groundskeepers, Leon and Phoebe. One summer while camping at Métis Crossing, a tune popped into her head. She dedicated this song to Leon and Phoebe as a thank you for helping her through some tough times in her life. That's Brianna Lizotte with For Leon and Phoebe. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The 2025 Juno Awards are coming up on March 30th. There are 15 nominations for Indigenous artists at this year's Junos, and many of them credit their success to a history of music and storytelling passed down through their families. Later in the show, we'll hear from Kim Gucci. Her latest children's album is a tribute to her mother and the grandmothers who came before her. The Dekath, Cree, and Tsekwepmuk artist took inspiration from her mother, literally.
My mom's been through a lot of medical situations over the last 10 years since I moved home, and one of the recent ones was a hip replacement and there was complications. So I spent a lot of time in the hospital with her and they were doing an ECG and I was standing behind the curtain and I heard this boom, 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 boom. And I was like, wow, actually that's a really cool percussion. And so I peeked in and I said to there was two nurses in there and I said, would it be okay if I recorded this? And they were like, why would you want to do that? And they were like kind of snooty with me. And I'm like, because I'm recording a children's album and it would make a really cool percussion. And they were like, oh, that's cool. Okay, sure. Come on in.
Kim Gucci coming up on Unreserved. What you're hearing now is Heart of Glass in Inuktitut. It's from the latest album by Elisipi. In the official music video, you'll see images of traditional Inuit life, what life was like for Elisipi's ancestors before the impacts of colonization. It's songs like this one that have brought healing for the artist on her journey, and the album that features it is nominated for 2 Junos this year. Elisipi, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you.
How would you describe the images in Heart of Glass? Because you do something really interesting with your videos, as well as language, as well as interpreting in your own way. What is it that you did with this video?
Well, Heart of Glass, actually, a film producer I worked with for all the songs in this project, in the album, we just found some archives and he was like, you know what, I want to try something and you go. I mean, let's go. And then it was so strange and I was like, wow, a black and white film of Inuit in the 50s before we were, while we were still nomads, you know, mm-hmm. just before we were forced to relocate to, you know, to create our little towns that we call villages or communities now that were pretty much in the 60s, right? So it was strange seeing this song in those images. And I was like, okay, there's something very innocent, you know, in the sound. And when I see my grandfathers, when they were put in front of the camera, all of a sudden there's this, life was so simple. Yes, it was hard. It's a hard life, you know, but it was so, so simple. And we owned every happiness and joy and and pain we owned, and we had power in our lives. So I think Heart of Glass, sang by Debbie Harry or Elisapi, by these two girls who are, who want to sing about joy and love and contrast. Well, to put it to the north the way it is, black and white, I think we deserve to be seen from a different point of view, not the same point of view.
What memories did this song evoke for you?
I remember being in this little hall. It's a tiny little place near a town where I'd go, where my mother is originally from, in Iwuyivik, near Salluit in Nunavik. It's a tiny little town, and we'd go there every summer. And then when we'd get there, all of us and all these, cousins who would be become my babysitters. My parents would, back then, the 70s, 80s, they discovered gambling, with cards and money, and this was like a new thing they didn't know about. So it was like a thing, where they get into the town with the family. My parents would leave with the adults, and this is springtime, so it's 24-hour daylight. I can still see how that golden hour, and then I'm in this place somehow with my babysitters who are listening to these pretty cool songs, and this song comes on. I remember it's so vivid. I don't have a lot of memory exactly precisely, but I remember the moment when this song comes on, and then I see long hair, hips, and these beautiful young people dancing, and we're just like, oh, wow, this was magic. There was something again so innocent and so beautiful, not really knowing what was to come very quickly after that time. So that's where this song takes me.
You've mentioned this time of innocence a couple times now. Your time of innocence as a young person growing up in the 70s and 80s, and the time of innocence before colonization, when Inuit were forced to leave their nomadic life. That seems to be sort of the pervasive emotion through this album, this sort of wispy, bittersweet memory that you're conveying through your voice in these songs.
It's not easy to explain really when you're from such a strong culture, like my uncles, my grandfather. These are pretty tough Inuit hunters, they've had to be very strong. So to talk about innocence and how you feel for these very strong people or very strong role models I had in my life, but to actually be able to say, I feel for you, I feel your pain that caused us pain, because these people couldn't really talk. They couldn't really say, wow, this is dramatic, getting all my dogs shot by RCMPs and stopping us from moving around. I mean, it was done in a way that was so unfair, and people could never say that. Nobody can say it was unfair. It's only us young people who are able to finally say, now I understand why we had such, our families were broken. All these elements makes it very confusing, I think, for the mind and the emotions. So I think music, these songs, I always say they were our friends. Going to California was my uncle's friend. Pink Floyd was my uncle's friend. Cyndi Lauper was our best friend, So it's like we were, and these are all white people's songs, I always say I stole music from white people, but actually they were our friend. These were the good people who allowed us to feel our emotions. Metallica, who allowed my cousin to finally, you know, acknowledge his anger and to be angry, you know, because we were also told not to be angry. How can you not be angry? You just lost so many cousins in a year over suicide. How can you not get angry, you know? So I think that's how I see these songs. They were our gifts, yeah.
What about for young Elisipi? When did young Elisipi discover that music and singing was the place that you wanted to express your feelings and your experiences?
I've always had music. I mean, every Sunday, my parents would go to the Anglican church, and my mother realized that, okay, I loved singing. So as a little girl, I think that's where I found, because I was very shy and very, very, sensitive, oversensitive. So I think music always, you know, has been my safe space. And then my uncle's band, Sagluk, of course, were a huge influence. I knew I had a very musical family. Yeah. And then when I was, 14, I heard a voice called Susan Agluka, who sang. And there was this, we had this cassette. My friend said, Elisapi, have a listen. And it just hit me like, oh my goodness. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, this is a girl, you know, girl. So yeah, it's very much Susan, I think, who changed a lot of our lives. Yeah,
she's such a beautiful human being. Was music a big, you know, a big deal in all of your family? You mentioned your uncle as part of the rock band there. How big a role did music play in your family?
I mean, just by having my uncles who, you know, formed a band in the 60s at a residential school in Churchill, Manitoba, I think they were so, it's not just because my family was necessarily just musical, it's just they were so unafraid to try things. They were singing in English, rock and roll, they were writing songs about, you know, so many things, and they wrote great songs, great melodies, great musicians. I mean, just having them around, you know, they were quite famous in the North, so I think it just allowed me to say you can do things differently. I mean, when you're from a small town, you kind of want to fit in, right? You want to be. But I think they taught me that it's okay to be different. You know, it's okay to try things, and you're allowed to be on the emotional side. You're allowed to embrace that, and I think just family. It definitely very musical. Yeah.
What do kids say to you when you say those things to them? Try new things, break out of the box, don't be afraid to speak out or to own yourself and to get out on that spotlight and say what you need to say.
I mean, being kids, I think they pretend like they might not have a lot of things to say about that, but I know they hear. I think just that message to say, oh yeah, you it's okay. You and also, you know, to tell them the time will come when you'll have to break free, right? Mm-hmm. So no, this is where you are. Things may not be easy right now, even at home or in your community or whatever, but sometimes we need to break free and just go, you know, find that space. And sometimes when we're young, we don't have that opportunity, but later on we do. So just keep in mind, things don't come like this. You build it and you have to thrive. You have to be hungry for it, you know?
Yeah.
Because not anybody is gonna make up your life, but it's you need to take control of your life. And
Yeah.
Also, just telling them that the opportunities will come. They're always gonna be there if you really want to meet those opportunities. You kind of have to break the shell, you know, a little bit and just
Let's sing it for those in the back. I want to
Yeah.
break free.
Yeah, exactly.
Except you'd
Yeah.
be a Nyctatut, obviously.
Matilama.
Yes, queen.
Yeah.
That's Alyssa B, 2025 Juno nominee for Album of the Year and Alternative Album of the Year. Alyssa B is Inuk from Selyuit Nunavik. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Indigenous musicians inspired by love of family and tradition who are sharing their music on a global stage. You're listening to the heartbeat of Kim Gucci's mom, heard through an ECG machine. It leads the rhythm of Kim's song, Heartbeat. It's the sound that links her to all her ancestors, to the many mothers and grandmothers who came before. Kim is Dakep, Cree, and Tsleil-Waututh from Kletli-Tene First Nation. On her album, Shanbe Natsuje, We Are Healing Through Songs, she shares her people's words and wisdom with the next generation. It garnered her first Juno nomination for Children's Album of the Year. Kim, welcome to Unreserved.
Hello, Rosanna.
Now, we just heard your song Heartbeat from your Juno-nominated album. Why did you want to make your mother's heartbeat into a song?
Well, that's a really good question, and people kind of raise their eyebrow when I tell them that I recorded my mom's heartbeat. My mom's been through a lot of medical situations over the last 10 years since I moved home, and one of the recent ones was a hip replacement, and there was complications, so I spent a lot of time in the hospital with her, and they were doing an ECG, and I was standing behind the curtain, and I heard this boom, 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 boom. And I was like, wow, actually, that's a really cool percussion. And so I peeked in and I said to there was two nurses in there. And I said, would it be okay if I recorded this? And they were like, why would you want to do that? And they were like kind of snooty with me. And I'm like, because I'm recording a children's album and it would make a really cool percussion. And they were like, oh, that's cool. Okay, sure. Come on in. So, and I also, I guess later metaphorically thought that that's like super cool to think, because that's kind of the first sound I ever heard.
Yeah, it is a really cool percussion. And of course, as a musician, that's what you would hear, right? Like, oh, I like that. Turn that into a song. And what did you think of when, you know, the song was done and you hear that beautiful melding of the two sounds and of course your beautiful singing? What do you think about when you hear her heartbeat in the song?
I go deep, because, you know, sometimes people look at somebody and they say, oh, you must be an Indigenous person. Well, my mom doesn't pass as an Indigenous person, but she's actually a descendant of Chief Nisqually, and she's actually next in line for princess status and within her family, if you follow that traditional way. But she's never really been recognized for who she is, and she hasn't lived in the Nisqually area in the Tsleil-Waututh Ulu for over 60 years. So it was a challenge, and she's lived in Kletli-Tene for 60 plus years. So we've been working on getting her status card, and I am very excited to say that last year she finally got her status, and we were sitting in the car at the mailbox, and she opened the letter and I had the video on, and my mom's not a crier, but she was so emotional. I was crying because I'm a crier. And she was just like, look at this. No more BS around the world. I'm a real Indian. And it was just such a powerful moment. So for me, that song, Heartbeat, represents that lineage. It represents the Tsleil-Waututh Ulu, the Tsleil-Waututh Sheen, all of my ancestors. I grew up close to my grandmother and my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother was a fluent speaker of the Sequoia-Machin, but it was back in a time where it wasn't acceptable to be an Indian. So you didn't even claim that status. So she sort of like just blended in. And so I didn't hear a lot of the language. And it was really important for me to have that representation on this album. And I thought, why not start with My Mom's Heartbeat?
Oh, that's a beautiful way to start. And what are you singing in the song, in the language Sequoia-Machin?
Hohois Jean is I love you. And Hohois Jean Kich is mom, like my mom.
That's so beautiful. Why is it important for you to sing in your various languages?
For me, as an adult in my sixth decade on the planet, I've never felt it to be more important than to do what I can as a musician, as an artist, to preserve language. I know you can never say never, but I don't feel that I will ever be a fluent language speaker, but I can be a language protector. So I'm contributing in the best way that I know how to take some words and to preserve them in my music. Like, my grandkids are so interested. I just spent time with them today and they're keenly interested, like, and listening and singing along to my album. And when I get in the car, they're like, Grandma, can you play your playlist? Which they don't really know how to call it a CD. And just having my little grandson, Raven, who's 7 years old, sitting in the back seat, belting out Territory Welcome Song is just, it's everything to me.
Yeah. And it's an everything that, you know, that wasn't supposed to happen, right? We weren't supposed to be speaking our languages. We weren't supposed to be listening to our songs. You speak three indigenous languages in your music, Dekath, Cree, and Sequoia-Machin. And yet you say you don't speak fluently. What was your experience growing up in these cultures and languages?
I grew up in a home where my great-grandmother was a language speaker, and she was fluent. She mainly spoke Dekath. So I grew up listening to her, and I never could understand her, but as a child, I wasn't interested. I struggled a lot as a young person, and my interests weren't as, like, focused on culture. But I was raised with it, and I was raised, you know, with the traditional foods and the hunting, gathering practices. And as an adult, I realized that this language, the Dekath language of the Tlaitli Tene people, was endangered. There's so few speakers left. And my grandmother, Mary Gucci, my Atsu, was a fluent speaker also. And she was one that was very willing to share it. I just grabbed onto her. And when I moved back 10 years ago, I had a few really good years with her where I was able to spend time and use my voice note recorder and document some of the words, some of the phrases, and some of her stories. So, and then as a Cree, on the Cree side of me, my grandfather on my father's side was a Cree man. And so I heard him saying a few words in Cree, and then I married a Cree man, and I was immersed in the Cree community and the Cree culture up in Moberly Lake, Soto First Nation. And the Cree language is one of the most melodic and beautiful literal languages. And so I picked that one up fairly easily, but it was the Sequoia-Machin that I had a very difficult time with because I really feel that I didn't hear it enough. But I know it's in my DNA, so I know it's there. It's just, it's not lost. It's sort of sleeping. I like to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to look at it. Who is this album for, Kim?
When I first set out on this adventure, I wanted to record a children's album in my ancestral languages. So it was for the future. But then I realized as we were going that it was very much for my inner child. And it was very much for the child in all of us, because there's so many of us that have been affected by our history, by residential schools, by the traumas that have followed. And so this album, Shan Be Natsuje, We Are Healing Through Songs, is literally for everyone.
Yeah. And as a children's album, what do you hope that it does for, you know, the kids who who want to belt out a tune in the backseat of the car.
It's happening. I go into the schools and perform to the full assembly of kids from K to 7, which is really a challenge because I need to be as fun and silly as I am cool and calm, you know, because I got to reach all of them. Mm-hmm. And it's a balance, and it's tricky, but I think I've found the balance. So kids, they've been captivated. And I think it's often the way I'm delivering it too. And I engage them. I get them to participate. I'm welcoming them to the stage. I'm welcoming them to sing along, welcoming them to feel. I let them know about how our bodies are a drum. And I get them to take their right hand and hold it over their heart and just to kind of follow the rhythm of the drum. And then we just kind of unify in that way. And I've had the beautiful pleasure of connecting with these kids. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience in sharing my music with kids. And I can tell you a quick little story about a kindergartner whose name is Hunter. And I have a song that I've written inspired by my grandson, Hunter, who's now 10 years old. And there was this little boy who was nonverbal and isn't able to engage in a regular classroom activity. And he has like an education assistant, and he, you know, is very active, but nonverbal. And his teacher said to me that when I played at one of their assemblies and he heard his name in the song, that he literally came alive and was spinning and twirling and vocalizing. And she really noticed this, and she was like, wow, this is something different. So the next day or the next class, she had a chat with the students and she said, we noticed how Hunter responded to Kim's song, so we're going to make this a regular part of our daily routine. So that's what she did. And it allowed them to gather around in a circle while Hunter was off to the side, and they would play the song in the classroom and everybody would dance and sing, and then Hunter would just come alive every single time. And it's been so wonderful for all of them. And it was a way for Hunter to be able to interact with his classmates, which had never happened before. So that's one story that I will carry with me forever. And so I just know that the impact of these songs, and there's literally on this album 16 songs, and I know there's a song on there for everybody. There's hip hop, there's everything. There's a lullaby, there's language, there's so much medicine on this album.
Mm. When you get to perform in front of Indigenous kids in particular, how do they react, you know, seeing and hearing language, songs about their culture and their experiences?
In a way, I feel like a huge part of me is doing this for them, is doing this because I want them to see what's possible, you know, because I was once that kid and I had no idea. I was so lost. I was so broken. I was raised in a home that was not a very good environment for a kid to be raised in. I was really hurting as a kid. So when I look at some of these kids and you can see and feel that maybe their home life is not good. And so I feel like this is at least a half hour or 45 minutes of a connection that could potentially help heal their hearts and could stay with them. I had a realization that a lot of these kids, especially the kindergartners, I'm probably the first concert they've ever seen. And they literally sit there with their mouths open, and they're just looking at me and doing the cute little waves, trying to get my attention. It's just absolutely adorable. And then there's the kids that are a little bit older that I know will remember me for the rest of their lives. So it's so important to me that what I'm doing and how I'm presenting myself is going to be a good experience for them, you know, like I take that quite seriously. And I never realized that in all the years that I've been doing these school shows that was a thing, that I'm like, wow, these kids are going to remember me in the same way that us adults remember somebody back in our childhood that's left that impression and has inspired them.
Mm. There's another family member who makes an appearance on your album. You mentioned her earlier. Spoiler alert. Let's take a listen to Atsushan.
An itzen hunzu Zayyachet awesden A katzak den nges Tlaktus jas nges Mai tunaye
An itzen hunzu Zayyachet awesden
Who is that beautiful voice in the beginning of that song, Kim?
That is my Atsu. That is my grandmother, Mary Gucci. My Atsu was a remarkable woman that really left a legacy. And she is the one that has inspired me to continue with the Deketh language and to learn about the history of our people. Our nation, the Tlaxcala Nation, formerly known as Fort George Indian Band, has been displaced, first of all, which has really had a huge impact on our community, and then the residential school, and then divided by a river. Our community is literally divided by a river. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So I used to say that our language is lost. I used to actually say that. And then I've realized that it's sleeping and it needs to be reclaimed. It needs to be brought back into the now. And so my grandmother is the one that has really inspired me to do this work and to learn about the history of our people, to look at our lineage and our ancestry, because there are still people who say, oh, you're not from here. You're from over there, you know, your ancestors came from over there. It's like, I can actually look into my ancestry and go back about six generations of my ancestors that were born at the riverbank there at what was known as Fort George. And so my grandmother was one that was felt that she didn't belong because she was told that for most of her life. And so I've really taken it upon myself to be a cycle breaker and to be the one to say, no, I claim this. This is where I'm from. My ancestors were born here. My ancestors' bones are in this earth. And I carry that with me. And I'm very proud to be a member of the Tlaxcala Tene First Nation.
Mm-hmm. What do you think your grandmother would say to you, knowing that you've carried on the language and are teaching other kids to sing along to this, to her language?
I know that she's so proud of me, and I can hear her voice saying, I am so proud of you, Kimmy. You keep going. Don't listen to anybody else. You keep going.
Well, thank you for sharing some time with me today, and congratulations on your Juno nomination.
Masi Cho, Tabase Nachalia, Cook's Jam, Nanaskamun. These are all the ways that we say thank you in my ancestral languages.
Kim Gucci is a Deketh, Cree, and Tsequetmuc artist from Tlaxcala Tene First Nation. She's nominated for Children's Album of the Year at this year's Juno Awards. For Sun Bay Natsu J, we are healing through songs. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hutchins-Lyle, and Amanda Gear. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kinanaskamit Nawau, Agusei.